Good day, and welcome to the press teleconference on NLRB versus Noel Canning conference call. Today's conference is being recorded, and at this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Jeremy Lemming. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Yes, this is Jeremy Lemming, Vice President of Communications at the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy. We're a nationwide network of judges, lawyers, and law students, activists, and others who are devoted to promoting the progressive principles and values of the U.S. Constitution. Today we have some distinguished scholars with us to talk about a case that the Supreme Court will hear oral argument in on Monday called National Labor Relations Board versus Noel Canning. And the case deals with the U.S. District Court of Columbia's interpretation of the Recess Appointments Clause of the Constitution. The D.C. Circuit took a rather narrow view of the Appointments Clause, and in doing so found that President Obama's nominations of several members to the National Labor Relations Board were not appropriate. For the call today, we have Professor David Strauss. He's a distinguished law professor at the University of Chicago, and he's also an ACS, also a member of the Board of Directors of ACS. And we also have Norman Ornstein, a renowned scholar on political science, and he's the resident scholar at American Enterprise Institute. Both of them have agreed to join the call and try to point out the importance of constitutional interpretation in this case, as well as the context in which the case arose. We'd like to start with Professor Strauss. Professor Strauss, the D.C. Circuit read the Recess Appointments Clause and took a little bit of a look at history, but came out with a rather narrow interpretation of this clause. Could you tell us what did the D.C. Circuit do wrong?
Well, thanks, Jeremy, and hi, everybody. This is David Strauss. As Jeremy suggests, this case started out as a pretty important one. Everyone knew it would be pretty important, but it's turned into something that might even be more important than that, just because of what the D.C. Circuit unexpectedly did. So here's the deal. I mean, as we all know, the idea of the Recess Appointments Clause is this. Normally, when the president wants to appoint someone to a judgeship or to a high executive branch position, the Senate has to confirm the appointment. But the Recess Appointments Clause says that during the recess of the Senate, the president can fill vacancies without Senate confirmation. The trade-off for that is those vacancies are only filled until the next session of the Senate, and the next session meaning basically the end of the next year. So if the president were to make a recess appointment in the middle of 2014, that person could serve roughly until the end of 2015, and then they'd be out. Unless the Senate confirmed them, they would have to leave office. What gave rise to this case in the first place was that the Senate, doing something that had been done in the previous administration, said, well, we're not going to have a recess. When we want to leave town, what we're going to do is have someone come in every 3 days and bang the gavel for a pro forma session. And the resolution setting up these pro forma sessions even said no business will be conducted. The session will just be convened and then immediately adjourned. And that way, we'll never have a recess. And everyone agrees that 3 days is too short to count as a recess. So that's why they did it every 3 days. There are other reasons, too, but that's the basic idea. President Obama, after getting advice from his Office of Legal Counsel, said, I'm not going along with that. These pro forma recesses don't count. And so I'm counting the entire period during which you're not doing business as a recess. That's long enough to make recess appointments. I'm going to make some appointments. Included in the appointments were two members of the National Labor Relations Board. That's important because without those two members, the NLRB doesn't have a quorum. It can't do anything. I think Rich Cordray of the Consumer Services Financial Protection, CFSB was Consumer Financial Services Board, was also a recess appointment under these conditions. So it looked like the issue would be, well, does that pro forma session count to interrupt the recess, in which case these appointments would not be valid, or does it not count, in which case they are okay appointments because the recess was longer. When the case got to the D.C. Circuit, and everyone thought the D.C. Circuit would just say yay or nay on that issue, and I think the administration has the better of that issue, but I think everyone agrees that issue is reasonably close. That could plausibly be argued both ways. I do think the administration's right. But it's a reasonable issue. When it got to the D.C. Circuit, what the D.C. Circuit said was, wait a second, as we read the recess appointments clause, and as we look at what we think the founders intended, the pro forma session thing doesn't even matter, because we think the president can make recess appointments at any time during a session of Congress. The only time the president can make a recess appointment is when Congress has adjourned, sign a die at the end of a session. So at the end of a year, before Congress convenes on January 3rd, if Congress is adjourned, that's the only time the president can make a recess appointment. And they got this mostly out of the actual wording of the clause, which refers to the recess of the Senate. And the D.C. Circuit said, well, it's a the recess. It doesn't say a recess. So we think there's only one of those, and it's the one that occurs intersession, not intrasession. Now, as a matter of just reading the clause, that's not crazy. What makes it really surprising is for about 100 years since the Wilson administration, both the president and Congress have been operating on the opposite assumption that recesses that come up during the session when the Senate breaks for a couple of weeks to go home for a holiday or for elections, but those are also times when a recess appointment can be made. And presidents have made literally thousands of appointments in those circumstances. And Congress, with a couple of occasional grumbles, Congress has got along with it. It hasn't, for example, tried not to pay those people. It hasn't protested by refusing to fund their agencies. It just went along. And the D.C. Circuit didn't even stop there. It also said, you know, as we further read this recess appointments clause, it seems to us to say that it's not enough that there's a vacancy during a recess. The office has to become vacant during the recess. So if the vacancy was around when the Senate rose for its recess, the president can't fill it. He can only fill vacancies that first become vacant during recess. Now, again, that's not a totally outrageous reading of the language of the clause. It's a plausible reading if you just go by the language. But what that does is to undo an understanding that's been around since the Monroe administration, when President Monroe's attorney general said it's not necessary for a vacancy to arise during a recess. And presidents have made any number of very important appointments under those circumstances. So what you've really got is not only the important question about these pro forma sessions, but you've got this, what I think of as a kind of fundamentalism, constitutional fundamentalism, which is, you know, we don't care. The D.C. Circuit, in effect, said we don't care that President and Congress have gone along this way for a long time, and it's in equilibrium, and both sides seem pretty happy with it, and, you know, it's a way for the President to push back if the Senate doesn't confirm the nominee, but the pushback comes at a price. We don't care about all that. The way we look at the text, the whole thing has to get thrown out the window. And I think that's a very surprising and in some ways very radical, really radical conclusion to disregard existing practice that both sides have acquiesced in or are comfortable with and have operated under for, in one case, almost 200 years. In the other case, as I said, for almost 100 years. To throw that out the window because we, the judges, have taken a look at what we think the framers intended and we think they meant something else. So what you've got here is really both the a fairly important, really quite important issue about pro forma sessions, whether the Senate, whether the president has that weapon to use against the Senate. And then this very deep question about whether we are going to empower judges to say, we are in touch with the framers, and we think the framers wanted to do things differently from the way everyone's understood the way they should be done.
David, thank you. And we'll get back to you with some follow-up questions in a moment. But I'd like to turn to Norman Ornstein, the resident scholar at American Enterprise Institute, to talk a little bit about context here. Norman, there's a tendency for some, maybe even in the press, to say, you know, what's the big deal here? Congresses are typically dysfunctional. They have been for quite some time. Moreover, maybe it's not such a bad thing that it takes a while for legislation and other actions to get done in Congress. It's a deliberative body, and so what's the big deal here? But it seems to me that you've touched on this, you and Thomas Mann in particular,
yeah,
in the book It's Even Worse Than It Looks. Can you tell us a little bit about the context and why it shouldn't be so easily shrugged off as, well, this is just Washington as is?
Sure. Just a few reflections. One is, I do think this is a breathtaking exercise of judicial activism. We go back to John Roberts' confirmation hearing, where he said that, you know, courts should decide cases, and that what he intended to do as Chief Justice was to decide cases on the narrowest basis that he could, rather than reach out and go beyond the specifics of a case. Of course, he did that with Citizens United, but this is an instance where it was clearly brought as an as-applied case, and it was pretty easy for the D.C. Circuit, if it wanted to, and the two judges, Sentell and Karen LeCraft Henderson, to rule on that narrow basis of the three-day recess. And that I can imagine going either way. And one important thing to keep in mind here is there's a real difference between this and the struggle that we saw with George W. Bush and Harry Reid and the Democrats when Bush was president and the Democrats had a majority in the Senate. When Reid put the Senate into recess for 3 days, the Senate actually did go in, and the majority wanted it to go in. In this instance, the Senate wanted to go into recess, and the House forced them to stay in session, in pro forma session, for one reason and one reason only, which was to block appointments. So what you had here was a really extra constitutional exercise of power by the House of Representatives intruding into a confirmation power in which it plays no role. And I think that's an important case to make, but it never got to that because, of course, this blew up virtually all recess appointments and took the broadest possible constitutional interpretation. I also view it with a jaundiced eye because I think traditionally courts have been reluctant to step into what have been struggles between the other two branches. The invitation to struggle that characterizes the Constitution, when you have a give and take between Congress and the executive, you will see each side using the tools available to it, and usually we generally consider that each side has enough fortitude and wherewithal to be able to hold its own in those cases. And you're not going to intrude unless there's a compelling reason to do so. And if we look at the broad scope of the exercise of the recess appointment, going back at least to the 1820s and moving forward, the interpretations made by attorneys general of what the power was and all of that, I think you could see it as fitting well within those particular boundaries. Now, there is a question as to what you define as a recess, but even there we had presidents from Teddy Roosevelt to Harry Truman pushing the envelope. Congress, of course, has plenty of opportunity to fight back if it didn't like those things. So we've got all of that on the table. And then we put it into a more contemporary context. And I think, and once again, we can use the contemporary context to go back to the framers. I don't think the framers ever anticipated, and it's very clear that they didn't, a role for the House of Representatives in the confirmation process. Nor do I think the framers anticipated a situation where a minority in the Senate would block large numbers of executive appointees, or judicial appointees for that matter, indefinitely or kill them entirely via filibuster. There was no such thing as a filibuster when the framers wrote the Constitution, and it certainly wasn't anything that was applied to any nominations for decades thereafter. Clearly, what we see in a contemporary context is a very different phenomenon. And if you went to, if you were somehow able miraculously to resurrect the framers and say, what would you think of a situation where a president has a majority in the Senate which has made it clear they are willing to confirm his nominees for executive appointments, and a minority in the Senate is using its power to block those nominees, they would say that's not what we had in mind. So I think if we're going to look at what the framers intended, we also have to look beyond the narrowest possible reading of the specific words in the recess appointments clause, particularly because we know that there was almost no discussion of them at the time by the framers. It was just put out there and accepted. And the reality that has changed very dramatically over the last 25 years. It began to change dramatically in the Clinton administration. It changed again for the worse in the Bush administration, and it's changed even more so in the Obama administration, leaving a lot of vacancies. For the first time, I think we could see with the NLRB in the Obama administration an intent to block all appointments, no matter how well qualified or with strong moral standing, to keep an agency from functioning as the law intended it to. And if there is no other outlet, which the recess appointment authority provided, then perhaps it's not surprising that what we see is the change in the Senate rules that came with the so-called nuclear option, although that's overstated given the original intent of a nuclear option in 2005. But that eases the tension here. But it doesn't take away from the notion of a court stepping in and basically really intruding in a big way on what otherwise has been this invitation to struggle between the branches.
Thanks to both of you. Professor Strauss, this obviously, you know, I think raises a big point of the importance of constitutional interpretation. The D.C. Circuit said, we've read the text of this recess appointments clause. We've taken a little bit of look at history, but boy, you folks have been doing it all wrong for about 100 years. What are we missing here?
Well, I think Norm put his finger on it. There are lots of problems with saying, well, we the judges are going to go back and commune with the founders and figure out what they thought about this issue. I mean, one problem is, as Norm said, there wasn't a lot of discussion about the recess appointments clause. Obviously, one of the things it was there for was to deal with situations in which the Senate had gone home for an extended period. They couldn't get back to Washington, D.C. very easily back in those days, and there were vacancies that had to be filled. You know, obviously, that's one of the purposes. But, you know, the framers, the people founding the country, they're right in the Constitution. They had a lot on their plate. And the idea that they were thinking about our issue back then is implausible. And that's one problem. Second problem, as Norm said, is, you know, things change. And there is no reason at all to think that the framers anticipated this situation. As you said, as Norm said, there was no filibuster back then. And the idea that a minority in the Senate would effectively say to the president, well, we're just not going to let you make any appointments to an agency if we don't want the agency to function, would have been, I mean, to the extent we can figure out what they thought, would have been an outrage, totally inconsistent with their with their design. But the main question is, you know, that's going to be, you really cannot imaginatively interrogate the framers about these questions to the extent you did. I agree with Norm that they'd be outraged at what is going on. But I think there's a deeper problem, which is this idea of saying, you know, we the judges can figure out what they thought. And we don't care that for, you know, 100 years or more, both the President and Congress have been pretty happy with this struggle and pretty happy to kind of duke it out in the way that presidents and Congresses duke it out. The President pushes, Congress pushes back, Congress calls up his appointees and gives them a tough time in oversight hearings or cuts their agency's budgets, and then the President can do things to retaliate against Congress, and they kind of work it out. You know, we don't care. We, the judges, we're in contact with the true spirit of the Constitution. We're going to say that all goes out the window. And, you know, I think that is an increasing tendency now with the courts to imagine themselves to have a deeper insight into the Constitution than generations of actual practice. And I think you saw that here in a particularly dramatic in a bad way sense when, as Norm said, you know, they could have resolved the pro forma session issue on which everyone agrees reasonable people can differ. As I said before, I do think the administration is right, especially in current circumstances. They could just have decided that. And had they decided that, while a lot of us would have said, had they decided that against the administration, while a lot of us would have said, look, we think you got it wrong, I think we wouldn't be as concerned as we are. But this is really kind of a very upsetting, in many senses of the word, decision for the judicial branch to come in and say, we just don't like the way things are being done, and on the authority of the framers, we're going to do things differently.
And before I open it up to questions, do you want to talk any about, you know, what do you fear, or what? How do you feel about the case before the Supreme Court now? I mean, I guess we can kind of guess about some of the high court justices that might buy this argument from the D.C. Circuit. Do you fear that we could have a majority of justices buying it whole cloth or more narrowly?
I find it very hard to predict what they're going to do on the broader issues, or even on the pro forma issue. I think there are some justices on the court who you normally think of as quote-unquote conservatives who are usually fans of executive power. Now, what they'll do is anyone's guess. And one of the real problems here, and it's a little bit technical, but it's a real problem, is because of the way the D.C. Circuit decided the case, the Supreme Court can't do what Norm correctly said courts ordinarily do, which is just decide the case on the narrowest ground. I mean, they could, but it really would leave things in an unsatisfactory state. Here's what I mean. The Supreme Court could say, look, we're not getting into these questions about whether Attorney General Wirth, James Monroe's Attorney General, was right to say that the vacancy can arise at any time. We're not going to get into that. We're not going to get into this business about the recess versus a recess. That we don't have to get into those. We're not going to get into those. We're just going to decide the pro forma question. And on that, we rule against the administration. These appointments are invalid because they were made during a session. It was a pro forma session, but that's good enough. And that ruling, they could issue that ruling, but the effect of that would be that what the D.C. Circuit said on these larger issues stays out there. And while it's out there, unless the Supreme Court repudiates it, it'll be very difficult, maybe even impossible, for presidents to make recess appointments. Because the risk they will take is if they make an appointment, and now, you know, they've lost the power to do it during pro forma session, but say they want to do it during the summer recess. If they make that appointment, and a later court comes along and says, agrees with the D.C. Circuit, the Supreme Court later agrees with the D.C. Circuit, everything that official did runs the risk of being invalidated. And that's a mess. And I think presidents will not want to create that potential mess. So I think even if the Supreme Court does what the D.C. Circuit should have done and try to rule on this case narrowly, they'll still basically have nullified the president's ability to make recess appointments, not nullified it completely, but in many important cases, for fear of creating a situation where these people exercising power, their constitutional status will be in doubt.
Okay, thank you. Moderator, we'd like to open the call to questions from reporters on the call. Can we do that?
Yes. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. And if you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment. We'll take our first question from Mark Sherman with the Associated Press.
Hi, I wanted to ask two quick questions. One is about the practical import of this ruling, following both the accommodation made to confirm the NLRB appointees and the and Cordray, and the you know, so-called nuclear option. And then secondly, what are we to make of the so-called principle at stake when the people on one side of the issue were on the exact opposite side when the White House was controlled by a different party? And that may even extend to judges, for instance, when the 11th Circuit, with a conservative majority, upholding the president's appointment power in the prior case over a liberal dissent.
Okay, well, let me give a take on both of those. In the first instance, you know, one of the interesting questions is just the reverberations that flow if the court affirms the D.C. Circuit opinion. You know, there's ample precedent for saying that it doesn't apply to other cases, but it's awfully hard to say that the entire recess appointment authority is demolished. It never really existed. But all of those decisions made, for example, by the Supreme Court when there were three recess appointments that Eisenhower made that were decided by one or more of those three, well, they're okay even though they were made back then, and you could go through hundreds or thousands of other decisions. It just reeks a little bit of Bush v. Gore. Well, it only applies in this case, never mind. But that's just a sideshow in a way. It clearly would mean, I think, that decisions made by the NLRB under the recess appointments would be invalidated, but at least presumably the current NLRB, which has been filled now through a fashion that may well be challenged. You can imagine a judicially active court deciding to intervene on the question of the Senate's rules. But other than that, the NLRB presumably could go back and reaffirm the decisions that it had made in the past. And when it comes to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, I'm pretty sure that any decisions that were made under Cordray could go back to and revert to decisions that were made by or could be made by the Secretary of the Treasury. But if not, once again, you could bring them up to date with a appointee who's now kosher under these circumstances. On the hypocrisy front, it's absolutely there. And let's face it, we did have Harry Reid go into these pro forma sessions when Bush was president in a struggle over these things. We do see real differences depending on who holds the presidency and who holds the Congress. And all we can do is try and step back and, as best we can, parse out what is rank hypocrisy and what is something that's different. What's different about the circumstances now? What's so interesting as the Supreme Court moves to take this on is that you have justices from Scalia and Thomas, excuse me, through Roberts especially, who have long experience in the executive branch and who've indicated great sympathy in the past with the executive. And if what we see now is a willingness to go whole hog and really undercut what has been a fundamental power of the executive, not just in a narrow way, but root and branch, it'll say something. It'll make us question where they are, since we've obviously moved from an era when the sympathy with executive power was in part because the executive was dominated by Republicans and Congress was dominated by Democrats,
to a very different phenomenon now, and we could see the same thing very possibly on the other side.
I agree with all that. Let me add two details. There is a doctrine. I mean, I agree with what Norm said about the ability of the labor board and Cordray to reaffirm their previous decisions. I think that's right. And also the Treasury Department could do a lot of what that agency did. There's a doctrine called the de facto officer doctrine that the Supreme Court pulls out now and then in situations like this. And the idea is, if someone was appointed to a job and he was doing the job, but there was a technical, quote-unquote, difficulty with his appointment, we're going to treat him as acting legitimately anyway until the issue was resolved. Now, once we've said you can no longer exercise power, you got to stop, but we're not going to undo everything you've done up until this point. And they pull that out every now and then. It seems to be a very ad hoc doctrine. Lately, they've been signaling they don't want to use it as vigorously as they have sometimes in the past. But I would imagine that the de facto officer doctrine would shield a lot of things done by recess appointees, even if the D.C. Circuit's decision were affirmed completely. And my guess is that's what the court would do in order to avoid total chaos, because you're talking in some cases about judges who have presided over criminal trials, and these people are now in prison, and their crime was committed 20 years ago. I mean, what are you going to do? Have a new trial or else release them? So in order to avoid that kind of mess, I would expect them to use the de facto officer doctrine. Now, having said that, one thing to keep in mind is, you know, at the moment, all we have is a minority in the Senate trying to block appointments. As far as I'm concerned, what the Republicans have been doing with respect to the D.C. Circuit and some federal agencies shouldn't even be done by a Senate majority. That is to say, the Senate majority, you know, if a Republican is elected president in 2016 and the Democrats have a Senate majority at that point, for the Democrats to say, well, that's great, you've been elected president, we're not going to confirm your appointees to courts or your appointees to agencies that we think it's in our interest not to have those agencies operate. So we're just not going to confirm a new Republican administrator to EPA. And you're going to have to live with the EPA that now exists being run by a career appointee who joined the agency during the Obama administration. I think that would be outrageous, even for a Senate majority. And if the president cannot make recess appointments, that's the position he's going to be in. That really leads me to one final point about hypocrisy. Of course, I mean, these issues, particularly these separation of powers issues, always breed a kind of hypocrisy that people who love the president when the president is of their party become fans of congressional power when they control Congress. One thing you didn't see in the read when the Democrats controlled Congress and Bush was president was this kind of across the board, you know, it's not about this, you know, the posture. It's not about this nominee. We just don't think this agency should be in business, and we're not going to confirm someone. Or we are just not going to let you make appointments to the D.C. Circuit. You did not see that. And I think one thing that, well, there's plenty of hypocrisy on both sides. One thing that people defending the Obama administration could now say is, you know, it's one thing for the Senate to do this pro forma recess game when both sides are sort of playing by the same rules. But gee whiz, if the Republicans' posture is we're simply not going to let you make appointments, then President Obama really was entitled to pull out this weapon. And it's a different situation now from what it was when Harry Reid used it.
Thank you.
As a reminder, it is star 1 to ask a question, and we'll take our next question from Mark Grunberg with Press Associates Union News.
Yeah, one question each for Professor Mann and Professor Strauss. For Professor Strauss, after the D.C. Circuit's decision, another decision along the same line but going even farther, and correct me if I'm wrong, came down from the Third Circuit in Philadelphia, where if I'm reading it right, ruled out recess appointments in all circumstances except for the cases between actual Congresses. In other words, where the 112th Congress adjourns and the 113th begins, that would be the only kind of time you could have a recess appointment. Talk, if that's correct, talk about the implications of that. And for Professor Mann, the Senate
Ornstein,
Republican,
actually.
I'm sorry, what?
Ornstein.
Ornstein.
The other guy.
The other guy, okay. with your co-author. Professor Ornstein, the Senate Republicans have 10 minutes of argument time on Monday. Do you expect the justices to get into the root cause of all of this, the filibusters?
I'll just take that one quickly. No, I don't. I think it would be very unlikely. It's possible that it will come up by the counsel arguing for the Senate Republicans, but my guess is that the justices are going to try to avoid any hint of getting into partisan politics, and that's what it would be right now for all the obvious reasons.
Okay.
On the question about the Third Circuit, I think it'll make a difference, but actually not that much of a difference. I mean, the fact is these intercession recesses lately have been, an instant long. What's happened is the old session is gaveled closed, the old session is adjourned, and the new session has immediately begun again. So there has been, for practical purposes, in most years recently, no intercession break anyway. So I think the changing from the break between sessions to the break between Congresses will not make that much of a difference. In Congress, the Senate could adjourn, sign a die without setting a new date if it wanted to, and that would give the President the ability to do this. I don't know why the Senate would do that unless they were, if they were willing to do that, they'd probably be willing to confirm the appointee anyway. So I think the difference between what the D.C. Circuit did and the scenario you outlined is it's not non-existent, but that's not the big thing. The big thing is really the difference between the issue that they should have decided, what about these pro forma sessions, and what they actually did, because both the requirement that it be either intra-session or intercession or inter-Congress, and the requirement that the vacancy must occur before the recess, those are the things that will really make recess appointments practically impossible for presidents in the future.
Thank you.
And it appears there are no further questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. Before we let you go, Professor Strauss, is there anything you want to add to the folks on the call that they should be paying attention to in oral argument on Monday? Or what would you tell, if you don't want to answer that, what would you tell an ordinary citizen who may not be familiar with the recess appointment clause at all, and there's probably a whole lot that aren't, as to why this case is indeed very important and they should be concerned about it?
On the ordinary citizen point, I think, you're right, the recess appointments clause, it was really a better world when the recess appointments clause was just some obscure little thing in the Constitution. No one was quite sure what it meant or what it did, and no one much cared about it. I think that was better because it's now become an issue of controversy because of these dysfunctional things happening in Washington. But I think what I'd say is that what's at stake, you elect the president, and you might wish he hadn't been elected, but he's the president. He ought to sort of have some leeway to do what presidents do, staff executive branch agencies in particular, appoint judges also. But really to get his government in shape and to be able to run his administration in the way he sees fit. And even if you think the wrong guy won the election, you got to give him his chance. And you might think he's probably going to fail. And if he does fail, I hope the voters will kick him out of office. But, let him run the government effectively. And what we've seen in particular since President Obama's inauguration is, I think, a refusal. And this is, of course, Norm Ornstein's the sort of leading figure making this point. But what we've seen is a refusal to allow the president to be the president on the most fundamental level. And although the recess appointments clause is this technical, weirdly worded little provision of the Constitution, and you don't want to overstate what's at stake here, part of this is about that. Are we going to let this guy who did win the election twice actually be the president? And that's the way I'd put it to a non-lawyer. As for what the court is up to, the thing I would watch for is whether they are flirting with the idea of adopting the D.C. Circuit's really far-reaching and, as I said, radical interpretation, or whether their attitude is, no, that's crazy. We're not going that far. and instead engage with the pro forma session issue, which, as I said, is an issue on which you can see reasonable grounds for disagreement.
So let me build on what David said. I mean, I think this case is very important, despite the fact that the Senate rules change takes away a lot of the potency of recess appointments from what they were before. One reason that it's important is it's a signal about how active this court is going to be when it comes to practices that have gone on, been done by presidents of both parties for a full 200 years, and been accepted fundamentally within the political context of the political branches, and basically throw it out root and branch. That is unusual. And if it happens, and if the court does affirm it, I would find it to be very troubling. A second question, and related one, is how far this court, given contemporary political circumstances, is willing to go to basically challenge the root of executive power at a time when we're going to see very likely more assertions of executive power, and how much they're going to take where we are now and let it affect a ruling, or we'll step back and realize that, you know, in future we're going to go through more and more twists and turns in who manages to run things. The other point that I would make is this, and again, reinforcing what David said, this really does build on the extraordinary level of dysfunctionality that we have now. If you look through the course of American history, we've had Congresses, we've had Senates that have played games with nominations, executive and judicial, made by presidents. We've had nominations blocked for parochial reasons, or for no good reason, or for nakedly political reasons, but there are very few of them. Most presidents didn't have to contend with more than a handful at most. And through most of American history, judicial nominations tended to go through with very substantial majorities. Now, it's true, the change really began with Democrats attacking Nixon appointees. I think you could point back to Judge Haynesworth as a trigger. But even then, we saw some restraint. Now, where you see delays in nominations going into the hundreds of days or years, so that people are left in limbo, can't begin to serve despite having been nominated, and it being very clear that if they came up for up or down votes, they would be confirmed. Nominations blocked by a minority via filibuster because you don't want an agency itself to function. Nominations blocked from courts because you don't want to have any of those slots filled by a particular president. That's just a very different phenomenon. And the release valve now is that rules change. It's unfortunate that it came to that. It would be much better if it hadn't come to that. And frankly, we would be much better as a society and as a political system if we could revert back to an earlier time frame where filibusters were not used in this way, or where you reached accommodations, as they did with a Gang of 14 in 2005 and into 2006, and you had these filibusters applied only under quote-unquote extraordinary circumstances, and you had a release valve like the recess appointment to ameliorate the problems that emerge when you get into these harsh partisan or ideological battles. But we aren't going to put those genies back in the bottle, and we just hope that the court doesn't overreact in this case. That at least is my hope.
Okay. Thank you so much. On behalf of ACS, I want to thank both Norman Ornstein, resident scholar of American Enterprise Institute, and Professor David Strauss, distinguished law professor at the University of Chicago Law School, as well as an ACS board member, for taking the time today to go through this NLRB versus Noel B. Kang again, which the High Court will hear oral argument in on Monday. We greatly appreciate their time and their insight into this case. And thanks to all of the other folks for joining the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And this concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation.